Hi, this is Paul. Jonathan Peugeot gave a really terrific lecture at Ralston College, and it was quintessential Peugeot. It was exactly who he is. It is exactly what he talks about, and it's a great example. The video I made this week is about immanentizing, and it's a great example of the move that he makes in terms of immanentizing. But I also want to point out some other things here. So let's just start with the lecture a little bit.
Judgment is actually a way to understand how identity formation functions. And I would even go a little further, but looking at this image and kind of understanding this image can help us understand how thought functions. That is, how it is that we come to bring things together and how it is that they break apart, right? This problem of attention, how it is that we're capable of having attention and how it is that our attention dissipates is contained in this structure. And all the weird things about it, once we understand that, we can see how the last judgment is not just something that happens at the end, but it is a perpetual reality.
Okay, so right there, okay? The immanentizing. Like this is in many ways sort of one of his main moves that has affected who he has become and what he is doing. And again, in the last video, I noted how there's, in many ways, especially after, well, we're going to get into the Protestant Reformation, Protestantism, images. I mean, because this is a fairly interesting and touchy area in a confessional tradition like mine, which is has some iconoclastic roots. So, but again, it's an immanentizing move. The modernists at the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century, they immanentized in a particular way, mostly surrounding morality. Now, Peugeot is immanentizing in terms of taking biblical symbolism and saying, this is how the world works, and if you want to understand how the world works, read the Bible. Now, everybody sort of says that. All preaching says that, because preaching is always trying to connect two worlds. And your mainline churches will say that, your evangelical churches will say that, all of your churches will say that. The question is the kind of language that they use to say that. And so what Jonathan is, in many respects, is sort of a Protestant preacher preaching from the text of church iconography. I'll say it that way.
Is basically an image of how reality functions. And it's not arbitrary to think that would be the case, because it is an image of the end. And you have to remember how the ancients thought of the end of something. It's not just the moment when the time runs out, but it is the moment that shows you the reason for everything that came before, right? We still use that way of speaking today, right? What is our end? That is, what is the purpose? What is the reason why we're doing things? And so the ancients would have understood the Last Judgment as being a culmination, right? As a kind of synthesis of all things towards their purpose. You could say towards their purpose, you could say towards their identity, towards what it is that they are, and how it is that we discern what things are. Sounds very abstract at the outset, but you'll see that once we get into it, it's not so difficult. Now, one of the things to understand is that in church architecture in the Middle Ages, the images were placed very deliberately. It wasn't accidental, the reason why we put certain images in certain places. And in this case, it's quite...
Now, that includes today. Where things are is not incidental or accidental. Now, of course, one of the big things to hit our culture was the whole Mark Driscoll strongman event, and this thing continues to reverberate. Now the pastor has a sermon where he basically says that the person performing was not a stripper, but was a world-class performer of sword swallowing and strength, something like that. So Driscoll, you know, has to repent, et cetera, et cetera. But again, what Jonathan's going to do here, as he does so often, is he's going to, and this is actually some of my Jonathan Peugeot favorite moments, because for me, I sort of look at these things and say, huh, well, that's interesting. And let's say, as I approach them by virtue of how I grew up as a Protestant in a Western culture, which very much focuses on intentionality, I try to figure out what are these pictures about. And then you look at the strange things about the pictures. The bodies aren't, say, proportional to what I think bodies should be. And again, all of that is within my frame of sort of a modernist physical correspondentism. Jesus should look like, let's say, a plain observer would see Jesus in Judea or the Galilee when he was doing his earthly ministry. And I want the pictures to physically correspond to that. And now, if you look at a picture like this, of course, there's nothing, and this is where everything gets tricky, because, okay, how does this correspond with what Jesus was doing on the cross? So of course this is the harrowing of hell, and he is saving Adam and Eve, and he's saving so on and so forth. And Jonathan will talk about this, and he will lay it out. And of course the cross, which bore him, now he wields sort of like a weapon, and on this goes. So here's the question. Jonathan is sitting here explaining this. He is exegeting the picture. And we all say, ah. So in a strange way, we're having a Protestant sermon on an artistic text in an ancient church. Now, you might say, well, that's kind of like art history. Yeah, kind of. But what Jonathan is doing is saying, oh, this means this, this means this, this means this, and a good Protestant says, ah. So here's the question. Now you see the keys and you see all of those things, and sort of the more biblical imagery you know, and especially the more, let's say, church father imagery you know, and that, in fact, there was a language being carried on building to building, church to church. Here's the question. Well, two questions. The first is, how intentional was this? And I don't think it was unintentional. It certainly was not accidental. And so as Jonathan sort of goes through the amazing elements, if I had done my due diligence, as Jonathan goes through the amazing elements of this, it's great, the question and answer. How do you know who's Peter and Paul? And Jonathan says, well, sometimes they just write Peter and Paul, but Paul, of course, is bald. You will see in my sermon this week that I'm using AI to make some things, to make some images, because, of course, AI participates and makes its images in stereotypes. So again, what Jonathan is doing is exegeting this and explaining it to us. Now, I don't know, and maybe someone can tell me, I don't know if this exegeting the wall was something that happened much. Well, maybe it did happen. Maybe it happened to those who were, let's say, carrying on the tradition of being iconographers and artists for churches. Again, there's an interesting moment when it's asked, well, how do you know that this is Peter, and how do you know that this is Paul? And of course, the bald head, the long beard and curly hair. Now, these are, of course, traditions. They're not physically correspondent, but they're... The point is that it then becomes a tradition, and the tradition gets passed on, et cetera, et cetera. So here are the questions. The first question is, and this very much is a big debating point that arises in the Protestant Reformation. And again, I think we moved into the Protestant Reformation in the 16th, 17th century, I think we're moving out of the Protestant Reformation, and protests will end. Now, it might take a couple centuries for protests to end, But we're at this point now of very interesting ecumenicity when Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestants are all sort of sitting around a table swapping notes and talking. I just saw that Chad is running his Friday morning conversation episode 2 with a bunch of the standard characters from the TLC in there. Now, what I'm going to play now is a clip I took out of my conversation with Wokal Distance. And it was the conversation about Searle and background, because quite literally, these pieces of art were in the background. And when you think about the, let's say, the ratio of, let's say, intentional, articulated, conscious, verbal processing, which Protestantism, which tended to major on the preaching, focused on, versus the background of people coming in to the church, seeing the pictures. How did they process the pictures? We really don't know. And notice again, we can't help but think this way. What did they think about the pictures? We don't know. Well, some of them might have said something. The vast majority didn't write anything. The vast majority didn't say anything. What do we care about what they thought about the pictures? Well, how did it change their lives? How did they change their lives in what way? At the Breakwater Festival, I've put it on my channel as a clip. You can find the whole conversation. I made the point that Orthodoxy is always focusing on the liturgy. Now, what's interesting about the liturgy is, in fact, audible, verbal, but it is still melodic. It is sung. It is liturgy. So, again, all of the traditions have liturgy. All of the traditions have Eucharist. All of the traditions have homiletics or preaching. All of the traditions have fellowship. Okay. Early on seemed to be, well, I don't know how early on. We know amazingly little about, let's say, the practices of the churches that Paul planted. To what degree were they sort of adapting synagogue worship? At what point did sort of the liturgy that you see arising in Orthodoxy, at what point did this stuff sort of arise and take on form? Of course, you're not having buildings with this kind of artistry in them until after Constantine. So again, you know, Constantine is still in the mix here in terms of, okay, how does this change things? One of the things that I was deeply impressed by visiting the Orthodox Church in Riverside after the Chino Conference and have continued to sort of mull over was the three-dimensionality of, the importance of three-dimensionality of the worship space as opposed to, let's say, my own tradition, which is very much meeting hall, plain church, very thin three-dimensionality as opposed to Orthodoxy and Catholicism, which can be much more richly three-dimensional. Lutherans tend to be more so. Again, some Anglicans, high church, low church, we tend to talk about. And in many ways, you can see where the Orthodox Church with their three-dimensionality is the heir of ancient temple worship. Because when you look at the elements of ancient temple worship, you have the sacrifice, you have an altar, you have a priest. All of that sort of gets translated over. But of course, with Protestants sort of demythologizes that, and it all gets very verbal. It all gets very intentional. It all gets very structured. So I'll pause now and I'll play that. I'm just going to slice it in here. I'll drop in that Wokal Distance clip about foreground and background, intentionality and background.
And so what he's seeing is So Searle talks about the background, the network, and the network of intentionality is all the ideas, all of your intentional conscious content, right? Everything that's about something, dreams, visions, ideas, thoughts, goals, all the artifacts of consciousness, the things that furnish your conscious world and your ideas. That's right. Intentionality just means ofness or aboutness. So anytime you have a thought of something or about something, that's intentionality.
Yep.
And he's saying you have a network of intentionality, all of these intentional bits of intentionality of knowing things and feeling things and having thoughts about things and imagination, and all of that forms a network of intentionality. And that gets meaning up against the background. And the background is a set of capacities, things like knowing a language, having a prefrontal cortex, being able to see, having senses, the capacity to use language, the ability to think. And the background, and he says this in his book on perception, he says, there's no hard and fast line between the background and the network. Just like there's no hard and fast line between a tree and its roots. They kind of bleed into each other.
Right.
And what's happened is that the larger background, when you have a shared background, your network of intentionality, you can use the network of intentionality to get clarity, to have meaning and to communicate.
Yep.
But when the background isn't shared, because meaning occurs in a network against the background, when the background isn't shared, then it's hard to create shared meaning.
Yes.
Communication becomes difficult.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's a great way to frame it.
And postmodernism is in essence the destruction of the background.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And that makes sense. What Searle says when he talks about reading, now here's the value of artists. He says that he read the Gulag Archipelago.
Yeah.
And he said, I didn't learn a single new proposition. I knew that everything had happened. And yet I had clarity, greater clarity about what went on in the Soviet Union. And he said, well, why did that happen? He said, it didn't increase my network. It flushed out the background.
Now for me, the sense making that I do with all of this stuff is, no, it's background. The liturgy. Again, they're having the Friday morning conversation episode 2. They're into music. They're talking about music. A whole bunch of them are musicians, and of course, in many ways, music is the three dimensionality of Protestantism. It really is. Protestantism sort of gutted the church in terms of visual imagery and three dimensional statuary. But then that space got filled with music. And even, you know, often as I'm worshiping on Sunday morning, and I'm often reflecting how in Protestant churches, whether they be monster truck churches, flagpole churches, whatever kind of church, music is the liturgy. And the worship leader, they're leading the liturgy. Now, in the Christian Reformed Church for many years, and actually what Pete does at our church is he pretty much takes stuff almost exclusively from the latest hymnal that the denomination has put out. And sort of the way that denominations and traditions captured and controlled and contained the liturgy of the church was by having a hymnal. Now, it's also interesting that in the Christian Reformed Church, there was a lot of emphasis on having the preachers scour the hymnals to make sure that the doctrine was correct. And so you'd see they couldn't sort of hold back the Wesleys, but they were concerned about, at the beginning of the 20th century, the first part of the 20th century in the Christian Reformed Church, the great danger that the church felt was that of Methodism. That Methodism was going to sneak into the Christian Reformed Church. I'd have to say that the Christian Reformed Church completely lost that battle in all likelihood. So they're trying to hold back the Wesleys. And of course, Charles Wesley writes these hymn after hymn after hymn after hymn, great hymns. And so what the Grace Altar Hymnal did in the Christian Reformed Church was tweak a few of the songs. You can let And Can It Be in, but that we can go in, not that all can go in, because you've got concerns about limited atonement. So you watch this processing. And so now it's very interesting watching this current revival with Jordan Peterson basically being a preacher of symbolic psychology, biblical symbolic psychology to the world, and then this renaissance of new people finding their way into the church. Jonathan Peugeot, preacher, you know, exegete of the church walls. It's not meanie, meanie, tekel, parson that he's exegeting. It's all of this iconography, and that sort of, that gives lift. And then people come into the church. But again, it's sort of about this inescapable Protestantism. Because whereas you might look at the church and say, oh, pretty pictures. And Protestants might look at the church and say, how do we know that these pictures have physical correspondentism that is correct so as not to lead people astray? Because, again, this is very scientific-minded, it's very technological-minded, it's very modern-minded, but all of that is sort of receding. And now, but yet, the big movement comes with the preaching of the wall. Maybe that's a good way to end the video. Maybe it'll make its way to the title. Leave a comment.
The catchphrase I say people, I say go to church. And what I mean by that is, in some ways, it's you have to engage in the human relationships around you. That's like the best way to go about that. You know, you have relationship, you have a family, you have some kind of community around you. And so that's the best place to go, because in some ways that's the place that will have this procedural aspect to it that will ground the other stuff. You know, it's like if you have to, you know, to help your kids with their homework, or you have to do this kind of really grounded stuff that has nothing, that's very little to do with the ideology, you get engaged in other people's lives, then it binds you in a different way, right? It binds you.
And then, like, my father would, he was going to church, and I wasn't really living with him, but he was going to church, and he would, like, kind of, those are elements of this conversation. Is I gotta go to church.
It's being part of a church is part of Christian discipleship. And in that word discipleship, there's this word discipline, which is, it's a discipline to go to church.
What would be so great about actually going to a church is, like, you start going to a church so that when you do need, like, to be prayed for, when you have something to be prayed for about, you have a place to just say that.
You're dead on right, Grizz, and that is what the church is for. To know and be known, to love and be loved, to have a place to go where people can pray for you, where they will welcome you in. And this is, again, part of why I'm, you know, I want churches to have estuaries, because it is, I know that it is difficult in many churches for people to, in a sense, come in and bring their real self. And what I mean by that is have to say what's on their mind, or you can't wrestle with them. It's like, you know, so Plato, you know, as John reminds us, is broad, so he's a wrestler. You can't wrestle over a screen. So maybe if it's paintball for Jesus, maybe it should be wrestling with Plato. Because, and in church, in a real space, now often it doesn't happen. I understand that. But at least there's a chance to actually have a relationship with grit. And that's part of why churches are local. They're relational, they're face-to-face, they're in real life.
Said about why would young people want to go to church. And I feel like I want to have some kind of dynamic message or something that if they do
find some reason to come. You know, I'm trying to fish, so I'm throwing bait and I'm trying to hook somebody. It's what Paul is doing too. It's, he said about being evangelical. It's evangelism of some sort.
Well, fishers of men is the
yes,
is the promise, yes?
Yes, correct.
He's possessed. We did go to church today. I took communion.
I don't go to church to think or to rationalize God. I go to church to worship Him, right? And that's, I'm happy with that. I'm very happy with that. And afterwards, during coffee hour, we can all argue about the God of our understanding, right?
Yeah. But I think you're right. I think that the wild twin, I mean, the thing that led to my sort of dawning to consciousness of Christianity, it was a 101 day vigil that I did in a forest, and I went into the forest.
You don't have to go crazy. Yeah. You actually have to go, you have to humble yourself and be, and do it right here, right now, right?
Get up. I like how Father Schmemann talks about it for the life of the world. He says it starts when you get up and get ready. And you walk, or you go to church. You start these. Those are simple. I get up, I brush my teeth, I take a shower, mm-hmm. I put on clothes, I go, the things of life, and we're ascending up into heaven. You're.